Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. Continue in our appeal to heaven to learn, pray, act. And we need to focus on full compliance of the Constitution, which means that we need to actually start pushing our public servants, especially your county and state legislators, to start upholding the Constitution. We need to start pushing them. We don't take, you know, we got to stop being nice because they're stonewalling us into ruin. And I really mean this because on this coming Friday, I'm going to kind of rant even more on how these county commissioners think if they drag their feet, you know, they can, you know, kind of change things, or maybe the desire of constitutional compliance would go away. And as a matter of fact, I don't believe that that is the majority. I just believe that the new conservative replacement out in Stevens County is viewed as this real champion of conservatism. And I'm telling you, folks, conservative does not equal constitutional. So with that, welcome back, Tammy. And so while we wonder and wonder, is Tammy on mute or not? Yep, she's not. She's here, and she's not muted.
I'm here.
So we actually covered a very, I'll just say, it was a very powerful assertion by James Madison. We were talking about the court jurisdiction, and he wrapped it up, folks, with all controversies directly between citizen and citizen will still remain with the local courts. How is it that federal courts now are dealing with citizen and citizen without any amendment to the Constitution, and actually with one amendment that tailored down the federal court's jurisdiction? So, it kind of goes to show that it's not like the anti-federalists were correct. It is that the courts and our politicians have been violating the Constitution to assume greater and greater jurisdiction and to assume greater power. It's not that the Constitution is giving it to them. They are assuming it. Okay. So now we've got Mr. Henry. And like I said, I usually don't in most of the ratification debates, but I'm picking on Mr. Henry. And I'm picking on Colonel Mason, because these aren't just anybody. These are big names. And I've even picked on James Monroe in at least once or twice, but in the ratification base. And that's just due to the fact, folks, that you have to hear their suppositions. You have to hear how they're casting this argument based on the Constitution is the problem, when every time it turns around, or every time the Federalists, you know, respond in kind, they still hold the ground that that's not constitutional. This is what's constitutional. So we're still on, actually, yeah, we just transferred over to Friday, June 20th. And so the second person up in speaking is Mr. Henry, Patrick Henry. So go ahead and let's pick up the common law here.
Okay. The appellate jurisdiction as to law and fact, notwithstanding the ingenuity of gentlemen, still, to me, carries those terrors which my honorable friend described. This does not include law in the common acceptation of it, but goes to equity and admiralty, leaving what we commonly understand by common law out altogether. We are told of technical terms, and that we must put a liberal construction on it. We must judge by the common understanding of common men. Do the expressions, fact and law, relate to cases of admiralty and chancery jurisdiction only? No, sir. The least attention will convince us that they extend to common law cases. Three cases are contradistinguished from the rest, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact.
Okay, right there.
Now, sir.
Right there.
Okay.
So what he failed to mention is the underlying clause in Article 3, Section 2, that the judicial, let me pull it up here because I'm going to read it as it states. And so Article 3, Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. So, if the federal government made some claims and it translated, you know, claims in a territory, and it translated into a state to become federal land, even though that land is not enumerated, that type of land and the purpose that that land, like a park, is being claimed, you know, as the federal government, then the, you know, and the state is, you know, doing some shenanigans and not really acknowledging or following it. The question is, does a park actually lie or arise under this Constitution? And no, it doesn't, folks. See, here's the problem. What ended up happening was the federal government started bullying and making these assertions, puffing up their chest and saying, you know, we have jurisdiction over this. And instead of the states pushing back and laughing at them and saying, okay, show me in the Constitution where this is enumerated. See, they started redefining things. They went down the path of doing everything necessary to be able to assume power. The real problem is that many of the people in the states, as they started doing this, went along with it. Remember when 1798 came along and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison put their foot down and says, we will not have this kind of unconstitutional behavior. And they created the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. What was the response of all of the other states in the Union? They didn't have a problem with it. And as a matter of fact, they countered to the state of Kentucky. And actually, their responses were different to each state. So in other words, the responses to Virginia's resolution came independently to the state of Virginia from the other states, and the response to Kentucky came independently. So I actually have, and I believe, because Woody pulled these up, so I actually have, I believe, the Kentucky responses, not the Virginia. And so I'm hoping to get both of them, because I want to put them up. I want you to see how these legislatures in these all of the other states were hem-hawing and actually making counter-accusations, you know, going as far as to calling, you know, what they're doing seditious and or treasonous. That was the problem, because the states, you know, if you, and as a matter of fact, didn't you just read it this past couple of days, that if people elect immoral people, we will have an evil government? Right? Remember they talked about virtue. Yep. If the people in office do not have any virtue, then we will have real problems. And that's exactly what it is. But I digress, because I believe differently. I believe that the people must bear and hold the standard of virtue to the oath of office. You got to remember that in the original Constitution, the one we're dealing with here, there was no teeth to a person violating their oath. There was, and it was very subjective. What are we going to do? This is why they were getting away with murder. Well, they're getting away with murder today, but maybe not back then. They weren't that corrupt. They weren't that, you know, evil as we are today. But, you know, like Teddy Kennedy. I mean, Teddy Kennedy got away with murder. Now, he's never been tried, but, you know, I've looked at the facts, and I think there's a there, but he never stood trial. The guy died, and there was never justice for whatever her name was. So the point is this, folks, that we now have Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, in a high-level general paraphrasing, no person can, while in office, if a person is in office under oath, can remain in office the moment they choose to violate that oath by not supporting the Constitution and or by directly violating it. Which means that if you directly violate it, that means you've passed or you've submitted a law that actually directly violates the Constitution, like, you know, giving amnesty or giving a pass and aid and comfort to the invaders coming into this country. And therefore, the only people that would not be guilty of violating, either directly violating and or failing to support the Constitution, would be those who actually charged those who did are doing nothing to hold them accountable, and those who directly violated the Constitution. Because both boats are based on Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. You cannot be in office anymore if you're not supporting the Constitution, which means you're attacking those who are attacking the Constitution. Then you can't be in office anymore. You're removed and you're banned for life. That ultimately is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And when you read it, and you read it, and you read it, and you read it, and after a while you get it, you go, oh my gosh, there is no due process. All they have to do is basically prove by the vote how that right there violated the Constitution. Because the Constitution does what when it comes to the invasion? It demands the removal, the repelling of the invader. If there's not a motion of seizing and repelling, in other words, sending that invader back to where they came, then you are failing to support the Constitution. And or you're, by making a motion to give them aid and comfort and give them, you know, a notice to appear in front of the court, that right there is a violation, a direct violation of the Constitution. And I hope you understand this, folks, because almost this basically affects everybody in Congress. Everybody in Congress is violating the Constitution. Now, Trump, he's even, you know, I think he's, dare I say, tiptoeing and dancing and segueing around this instead of actually holding people accountable. His DOJ, his Secretary of the Department of Justice, his Attorney General, should have and actually should be taking the charge and leading in removing everybody who is not standing up to repel the invasion. So we're actually pushing our petition 3, which is, you know, to repel the invaders. And we're actually going to be pushing this with an expectation to the Department of Justice to demand that they remove these politicians in the state of Washington, because they are, you know, segueing, dancing, and doing everything but supporting the Constitution. So, anyway, so getting back to what Mr. Henry is saying here, in all cases, this is basically what he's saying, the three cases are contradistinguished from the rest. In all cases affecting ambassadors or other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. So that was changed by the 11th Amendment, by the way. But when it comes to a state, like, I'll give you a case in point. When it comes to a state such as the state of Washington that is denying the exportation of Wyoming coal go through their ports, don't even bring it through our state, we're not going to allow it out our port. The state of Washington has violated the Constitution. The fact that that international port is allowed to operate is due to the Constitution. It is not there to serve the state of Washington. It is there to serve all states in the Union. You can't cherry pick what products you want and don't want to go through your port. It is a violation of the Commerce Clause. All states must allow interstate commerce to flow through it. You can't dictate, well, we don't like your commerce, it can't come through here. So why is it that there's nobody in Wyoming that has been, you know, standing up and you know, I'll just say, haranguing the federal courts, or I should say, Trump today. Why is nobody going to? Because this actually started even before Trump got in office, if I remember correctly, or while he was in office, they started putting the kibosh on shipping or the transshipment of coal to foreign ports. And that has been a huge negative, a financial negative on Wyoming. And Wyoming right now is strapped. I know that Wyoming is so dependent on federal dollars. Boy, if they were actually allowed to conduct commerce the way they should be able to, I don't think they'd be in the same situation. That's key right there. So go ahead and pick it up from now, sir.
Now, sir, what are we to understand by these words? What are the cases before mentioned, cases of common law as well as of equity and admiralty? I confess I was surprised to hear such an explanation from an understanding more penetrating and acute than mine. We are told that the cognizance of law in fact is satisfied by cases of admiralty and chancery. The words are expressly against it. Nothing can be more clear and incontestable. This will in its operation destroy the trial by jury. The verdict of an impartial jury will be reversed by judges unacquainted with the circumstances. But we are told that Congress are to make regulations to remedy this. I may be told that I am bold, but I think myself, and I hope to be able to prove to others, that Congress cannot, by any act of theirs, alter this jurisdiction as established.
Okay, so we're going to go down when John Marshall steps in on this. But before we do, keep in mind that chancery issues that are in court, or I should say cases that would be brought before the court in admiralty and chancery, would not be things that arise under this Constitution. It would be things arising in disputes with foreign nations, such as, you know, not giving our ambassadors, you know, access or being able to do, you know, why they're there. I mean, everybody knows about diplomatic immunity. It's gotten to a point where, you know, diplomats in any country can literally wreak havoc. They can, you know, they're beyond search and seizure. There's this level of protection that is afforded the chancery. And it's the same thing with admiralty, as same as maritime. And so those laws do not affect directly states. The only time a state is affected is if a state is engaged in commerce overseas and they actually get hit with charges that would drag them into an admiralty court or a maritime court. The point is that who should have the jurisdiction over that? Should each of the states? Because I'll tell you, the small states that don't have the money would not be able to afford and actually have the clout to protect themselves. This is one of the reasons why, in the Articles of Confederation, certain states had distinct advantages with trade and enforcement and so forth, because they had the clout. They had a little more clout than Delaware, than Georgia, these small little teeny states. So let's dive into the first note by John Marshall. We've got two notes, and then we got common law. Go ahead.
Okay, there is a little blurb that's highlighted for me.
Oh, okay. Is there?
Henry's still.
Oh, okay. Go ahead and finish. You're right. I missed that. Go ahead and say that.
Okay. They may be tried by the most partial powers, by their most implacable enemies, and be sentenced and put to death with all forms of fair trial. I would rather be left to the judges. An abandoned juror would not dread the loss of character like a judge. From these and a thousand other considerations, I would rather the trial by jury were struck out altogether. There is no right of challenging partial jurors. There is no common law of America, as has been said, nor constitution, but that on your table. If there be neither common law nor constitution, there can be no right to challenge partial jurors. Yet the right is as valuable as the trial by jury itself.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for finding that. So, okay, so let's go into Mr. Marshall, and because this is before he becomes a judge. This is when he was, you know, still friends with Hamilton, and I still believe, I'd like to find all of the letters between Hamilton and him, but let's go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, this part of the plan before us is a great improvement on that system from which we are now departing. Here are tribunals appointed for the decision of controversies which were before either not at all or improperly provided for. That many benefits will result from this to the members of the collective society, everyone confesses, unless its organization be defective and so constructed as to injure instead of accommodating the convenience of the people, it merits our approbation. After such a candid and fair discussion by those gentlemen who support it, after the very able manner in which they have investigated and examined it, I conceived it would be no longer considered as so very defective, and that those who opposed it would be convinced of the impropriety of some of their objections. But I perceive they still continue the same opposition. Gentlemen have gone on an idea that the federal courts will not determine the causes which may come before them with the same fairness and impartiality with which other courts decide. What are the reasons of this supposition? Do they draw them from the manner in which the judges are chosen or the tenure of their office? What is it that makes us trust our judges? Their independence in office and manner. Okay. Are not the judges of the federal court chosen with as much wisdom as the judges of the state governments? Are they not equally, if not more, independent? If so, shall we not conclude that they will decide with equal impartiality and candor? If there be as much wisdom and knowledge in the United States as in a particular state, shall we conclude that the wisdom and knowledge will not be equally exercised in the selection of judges?
Okay, keep going. Yeah, uh-huh.
The principle in which they object to the federal jurisdiction seems to me to be founded on a belief that there will not be a fair trial had in those courts. If this committee will consider it fully, they will find it has no foundation and that we are as secure there as anywhere else. What mischief results from some causes being tried there? Is there not the utmost reason to conclude that judges wisely appointed and independent in their office will never countenance any unfair trial? What are the subjects of jurisdiction? Let us examine then with an expectation that causes will be as candidly tried there as elsewhere and then determined. The objection, which was made by the honorable member who was first up yesterday, Mr. Mason, has been so fully refuted that it is not worth while to notice it. He objected to Congress having power to create a number of inferior courts according to the necessity of public circumstances. I had an apprehension that those gentlemen who place no confidence in Congress would object that there might be no inferior courts.
Okay, so hold on.
That I thought those.
So hold on right there. So previously, that first paragraph, it was really talking about, you know, it just comes down to the character. Can we not expect bad behavior from anybody? Can we not expect good behavior from anybody? You know, in other words, let's go back to the virtues. Let's go back to, you know, what causes people to be good. But right in here is where he's actually getting into the meat of what was being said. And he said that according to the necessity of public circumstances, they're going to increase, I'm paraphrasing, they're going to increase these inferior courts. And then he said he had this apprehension that who placed no confidence in Congress that they would actually, you know, do what they needed to do. So it is the state's job. It is the defendant's job to take a stand and say, you have no jurisdiction. Before a case can actually convene, we're going into a break right here, but before a case can actually convene in court, you have to prove jurisdiction and standing. Now, remember, folks, we've heard these terms a lot out of the courts lately, and it actually is how the courts proved that their hands were tied. They couldn't hear your case. And so I understand that the courts are absolutely tyrannical, that they're going to, you know, speak out of both sides of their mouth. But the states have the ability to push back. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So whenever I see somebody use these use this kind of language, and this is what he said, the objection which is made by the honorable member who was first up yesterday, Mr. Mason, has been so fully refuted it is not worthwhile to notice it. To me, that is hyperbole, because it may have already been refuted, and maybe at this point he should be addressing Patrick Henry. But why did he do that? And if you really think about it, this is simply posturing to absolutely, you know, attack the character, that person that, you know, they made a baseless claim. And why, if you're not going to dive into substance on an old act, then why even bring Mason into this? Does that make sense? Now, got to remember that Marshall is a Federalist, and so Marshall is going to speak very clearly to what the real letter of the Constitution is to be. Now, when Marshall becomes a court justice, then he can say whatever he wants in an opinion. Why? Because an opinion is an opinion is an opinion. It's babble. I mean, you don't even have to be honest in an opinion. Right? It is an opinion.
Right.
And so I go with, and I've stood on this, that the only reason Madison and Jefferson allowed Marshall to babble his, you know, flap his gums was just due to the fact that though that was just an opinion part of the case. It had no weight. Based on the Constitution, there was no weight to an opinion. There was no such thing as case law and precedents. They didn't start doing that until the 1830s, when everybody had died off except for Madison, and Madison was well into his geriatric phase. So we now see how it was a game of waiting. It was a game of patience to slowly let the monster out of the box. Because down the road, who's going to remember what Madison said? Well, you got to go to the ratification debates to clarify everything. And by this point in time, Marshall had already done his damage. And how did he do his damage? He brought the Federalist Papers in as the gold standard in understanding the Constitution, and actually denigrated the real gold standard and the only legal references or the only legal standards of understanding the Constitution by contract law were the ratification debates. So we denigrated the ratification debates. And this is why lawyers today, my friends, if you ever talk to a lawyer and they talk about the ratification debates, those are just worthless. No, the Federalist Papers, because these men were of character. And the reality is the Federalist Papers were editorials. These men were not under oath. These men could not be held to perjury. What was being stated by the Federalists, these men in their debates were under oath. So who do you give credence to? And you see how Marshall, so this is why I, you know, he has not spoke much, right? This is where he's starting to show up in the debates and what he's saying. Mm-hmm. And so I'm helping you get a caveat here. Marshall may be on with the exact letter of the law. Down the road, Marshall turns into the implied powers and the federal government can do anything it wants to do. In other words, he literally starts speaking out of the other side of his mouth once he becomes a Chief Justice. So just keep that in mind, because Hamilton was the same way. As soon as the Constitution was ratified, and as soon as the New York State got into it, he didn't even really try. After he found out that the Virginia had ratified the Constitution, it was all done. They knew that the largest state in the Union was going to be a part of the Union. New York was going to be in it as well. There's no way New York was not going to get into the Union and be out of it while Virginia was going to be able to do her folly and take control or what have you, because these big cabals had, I guess these guys had expectations of somehow, corrupting the federal government, which is, unfortunately, is what they did. None of it was constitutional. None of it was legitimate. But the point is that, yes, they're going to constantly try to break through that parchment barrier. Whose job is it to keep them in check? We, the people, and our legislators at the county and the states, we have to keep them attuned to constantly, as Madison states, we must oppose every infraction and hold them accountable. And if we're not doing that, then we're not doing our job. And that right there, to me, is the whole point of why this Constitution is perfect. It's perfect when the body functions. And when I say the body, I mean every component, from the people to their lower legislators, to the state legislators, to the federal government, holding everybody accountable. Go ahead and take it from there.
I own that I thought those gentlemen would think that there would be no inferior courts, as it depended on the will of Congress, but that we should be dragged to the center of the Union. But I did not conceive that the power of increasing the number of courts could be objected to by any gentleman, as it would remove the inconvenience of being dragged to the center of the United States. I own that the power of creating a number of courts, in my estimation, so far from being a defect, that it seems necessary to the perfection of this system, after having objected to the number and mode, he objected to the subject matter of their cognizance. Here, Mr. Marshall read the second section.
Okay, so what's the second section? That's the jurisdiction. That's what I've been reading each time. And folks, what that is, like I said, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. So in other words, it only extends to those enumerated objects within the Constitution. So go ahead.
These, sir, are the points of federal jurisdiction to which he objects, with a few exceptions. Let us examine each of them with a supposition that the same impartiality will be observed there as in other courts, and then see if any mischief will result from them. With respect to its cognizance in all cases arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States, he says that the laws of the United States being paramount to the laws of the particular states, there is no case but what this will extend to. Has the government of the United States power to make laws on every subject? Does he understand it so? Can they make laws affecting the mode of transferring property or contracts or claims between citizens of the same state? Can they go beyond the delegated powers? If they were to make a law not warranted by any of the powers enumerated, it would be considered by the judges as an infringement of the Constitution, which they are to guard. They would not consider such a law as coming under their jurisdiction. They would declare it void.
Okay, so right there, what he just basically said is, if they try to make a law that goes beyond, can they go beyond the delegated powers? You see that? So in other words, if Congress can't make laws beyond the delegated powers, and if they try to do that, the court will actually say, you don't have the ability to do that. And they would consider, like he says, it would be considered by the judges as an infringement of the Constitution, which they are to guard. See, so the court actually has a responsibility of guarding the Constitution. And yet they were the first to attack as soon as he donned his robe. Go ahead and pick it up from there.
It will annihilate the state court, says the honorable gentleman. Does not every gentleman here know that the causes in our courts are more numerous than they can decide according to their present construction? Look at the dockets. You will find them crowded with suits which the life of man will not see determined. If some of these suits be carried to other courts, will it be wrong? They will still have business enough.
Okay, so now we go down a little bit further, and there's another little note. Now, you know, folks, we hop over some of these little things, so I could easily just include all of it just to be more thorough, but you may want to take the time to kind of read through these things, because it's not like he turns off, you know, his vim and vigor regarding, you know, his retorts to Patrick Henry. But keep going.
How disgraceful is it that the state courts cannot be trusted, says the honorable gentleman. What is the language of the Constitution? Does it take away their jurisdiction? Is it not necessary that the federal courts should have cognizance of cases arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States? What is the service or purpose of a judiciary but to execute the laws in a peaceable, orderly manner without shedding blood or creating a contest or availing yourselves of force? If this be the case, where in its jurisdiction be more... I'm not really sure what they mean by this, but where in its jurisdiction be more necessary than here?
Yeah, so that's a little bit of... I think whoever wrote that down didn't capture right, or something got lost in translation, what have you. But, yeah. The point is it not necessary that the federal courts should have at minimum cognizance of cases arising under the Constitution that they're supposed to be executing, their roles, responsibilities? Now, folks, you got to remember, if you look at the enumerated color-coded Constitution, we have two now, the enumerated color-coded Constitution lays out what their... This is a role. When you're reading this clause, like when you go into Article 1, Section 1, that's a role. That's a responsibility. That's not a power. That means that Congress cannot make a law regarding the words or the clauses within that section. They can't make a law regarding Section 2, which is why we have two color codes. We have a green color code for the overall text area. And you'll see that there's like a light green, very light, like more like an olive or, you know, a drab, but it's very light. And then there's kind of a mauve or a pink area that is very light in the background. And then there's a gray. The green means that they can make law in this section, this area of text, because we use these different highlights that are proving that this is a standard, this is a role, this is a power, blah, blah, blah. So, you can actually break it down by clause what it is. And in that clause, in that area, those areas are subject to congressional regulations and or laws and or what have you. If you look at it, you will realize that probably a very small fraction of the Constitution does Congress have power to create law or to be able to create a treaty, because they can only create law or treaties regarding those enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. There may be a few other areas where they might have the ability, like in Article 4, Section 3, in admitting new states into the Union, they have the ability to make rules and regulations for the territory, but not for states. So once the territory transitions into a state, they have no authority to be in the state's knickers, to create laws regarding that land or anything. That is now state-owned and state-independently sovereign entity. It's theirs. So now he dives into common law. So let's dive into that.
To what quarter will you look for protection from an infringement on the Constitution if you will not give the power to the judiciary? There is no other body that can afford such a protection. But the honorable member objects to it because he says that the officers of the government will be screened from merited punishment by the federal judiciary. The federal sheriff says he will go into a poor man's house and beat him or abuse his family, and the federal court will protect him. Does any gentleman believe this? Is it necessary that the officers will commit a trespass on the property or persons of those with whom they are to transact business? Will such great insults on the people of this country be allowable? Were a law made to authorize them, it would be void.
Okay, so he's making hyperbole, but the reality is, if you really look out the gate, when it came to the federal government getting involved in any individual life, where, you know, they were going into their homes and you know, doing seizures and confiscations, that was not a problem with the federal government. If there was a problem where its citizens were being harassed, it was the states doing the harassing. I want to be clear. The states were the bad actors. They went after people because of their racial makeup, because of their religious makeup, or what have you. When, you know, if you were an outlier in a state, you were going to be harassed. And that was the fact. Because they didn't like your kind here. Regardless of what you're, you know, how you made yourself different. However you were distinguished as different. So, go ahead.
The injured man would trust to a tribunal in his neighborhood. To such a tribunal, he would apply for redress and get it. There is no reason to fear that he would not meet that justice, that he would, hold on, lost my place. There is no reason to fear that he would not meet that justice there, which his country will be ever willing to maintain. But on appeal, says the honorable gentleman, what chance is there to object to obtain justice? This is founded on an idea that they will not be impartial. There is no clause in the Constitution which bars the individual member injured from applying to the state courts to give him redress. He says that there is no instance of appeals as to fact in common law cases. The contrary is well known to you, Mr. Chairman, to be the case in this Commonwealth. With respect to Mills, Rhodes, and other cases, appeals lie from the inferior to the superior court as to fact as well as law. It is a clear case that there can be no case in common law in which an appeal as to fact might be proper and necessary. Can you not conceive a case where it would be productive of advantages to people at large to submit to that tribunal the final determination involving facts as well as law? Suppose it should be deemed for the convenience of the citizens that those things which concern foreign ministers should be tried in the inferior courts. If justice could be done, the decision would satisfy all. But if an appeal in matters of facts could not be carried to the superior court, then it would result that such cases could not be tried before the inferior courts for fear of injurious and partial decisions.
Keep going.
But, sir, where is the necessity of discriminating between the three cases of chancery, admiralty, and common law? Why not leave it to Congress? Will it enlarge their powers? Is it necessary for them want only to infringe your rights? Have you anything to apprehend when they can in no case abuse their power without rendering themselves hateful to the people at large? When this is the case, something may be left to the legislature freely chosen by ourselves from among ourselves, who are to share the burdens imposed upon the community and who can be changed at our pleasure. Where power may be trusted and there is no motive to abuse it, it seems to me to be as well to leave it underdetermined as to fix it in the Constitution.
Okay, so now we kind of skip down and we go to, you know, Mr. Grayson, this is the next day, Saturday the 21st. And so this is the summer solstice, right? Yeah, winter solstice and summer solstice, the 21st of June. So the 21st of June, Mr. Grayson makes a comment regarding common law. And so this is where he starts making observations. And it's in some ways, he appears, so he's an anti-federalist, but he appears to like he's really trying to get it. But the denseness of his brain is just having a hard time. It was, you know, him that actually went back and forth with Madison regarding, you know, uncivil behavior You know, can you come up with a point of that? And Madison said, yeah, a riot is something that is not is unacceptable. When the people are protesting and rioting, the sheriff would need to basically, you know, utilize the militia to suppress a riot. It doesn't necessarily have to be an insurrection. See, an insurrection, what is an insurrection? It is an outright defiance of law, right? When your child, folks, if you're a parent, has your child ever had a little insurrection against the house and the rules of the home? Of course they have. They challenge the law. That, by definition, is an insurrection. But when people get mad, and you know, when you're sitting there, and all of a sudden, you know, everybody's, you know, emotions are just, for some reason, the family is on edge, right? You know, and who knows, girls, boys, it doesn't matter. It only takes one to start pulling the strings that they know really upset them. You know, like you know, a boy that, you know, can't, you know, isn't good in sports or something, or whatever, they're starting to nag on each other. And it inflares into this huge brawl. That right there is riotous behavior. It's not like they're trying to defy the law of the home. It is an outlash and, you know, I find this unacceptable, blah, blah. So it's not... That is a riot versus an insurrection. So Mr. Grayson just had a hard time getting that earlier. And so he's going to make some comments, and he's actually going to make the case for the Constitution in helping establish the relationship between the legislative bodies. Because he actually says that the county to the state legislature is the county legislature to the state government is in the same relationship as the state legislature to the federal government. Yes, absolutely. So he falls backwards into getting something right. And I don't think that was his intention. I think it actually was a slip up on him that he connected those dots. But that's a little bit ways down the road here. So let's go ahead and read this.
Okay. There is to be one Supreme Court for Chancery, Admiralty, Common Pleas, and Exchequer, which great eases are left in England to four great courts, to which are added criminal jurisdiction in all cases depending on the law of nations, a most extensive jurisdiction. This court has more power than any court under heaven. One set of judges ought not to have this power, and judges, particular, who have temptation always before their eyes. The court thus organized are to execute laws made by 13 nations dissimilar in their customs, manners, laws, and interests. If we advert to the customs of these different sovereignties, we shall find them repugnant and dissimilar. Yet they are all forced to unite and concur in making these laws. They are to form them on one principle and on one idea, whether the civil law, common law, or law of nations. The gentleman was driven the other day to the expedient of acknowledging the necessity of having 13 different tax laws. This destroys the principle that he who lays a tax should feel it and bear his proportion of it. This has not been answered. It will involve consequences so absurd that I presume they will not attempt to make 13 different codes. They will be obliged to make one code. How will they make one code without being contradictory to some of the laws of the different states?
Okay, so one of the things... got 4 minutes left. So one of the things that I believe that, you know, needs to be discussed regarding how do we fix the judiciary based on the Constitution, because our government has become so big that I believe the magnitude of the representation has been lost. In other words, we're to have a Republican form of government, right? That's a, you know, mm-hmm. question to you, Tammy. She's nodding her head, and I see that. So, Okay, so we're to have a representative government. But how is it that our court represents us? When you really look and take a minute and look at the origins of each justice, the justices are coming from schools of thought. And as a matter of fact, the majority of the justices are coming from Ivy League. Is that representative of America? Now, I'm not to say one school of thought and another school of thought be, you know, different, equal, or not. But what I am saying is that we should, just like Congress and just like the Electoral College, make sure that each state has a, you know, a dog in the fight, or I should say a dog in the branch of government. And I believe that the Supreme Court could easily be made up of one justice and get rid of all the inferior courts. I don't think you need inferior courts, especially when you actually hone down or keep the federal courts from opening their doors to anything and everything under the sun. They want to do this because this is how they've been legislating. And the states need to make sure that those doors only open to things that are arising under this Constitution. Therefore, you actually get judges, and instead of making them permanent positions, the position is a permanent seat for the state of Washington, a permanent seat for the state of Wyoming. That each state will actually have a seat, and the people, and or I will say this, you know, you can go down the legislature or the governor. I kind of lean towards the executive, giving them the ability to, with advice and consent of the legislature, to seat that their own justice. Therefore, the only time that there would need to be two federal appointments from the president would be if we had an odd number. In other words, if we had 49 states, then we should have 51 justices to ensure that there could never be a tie. And so you'd have a chief justice and you'd have an assistant chief justice. And when a new state joins the union, guess what? The assistant chief justice, if he hasn't, you know, moved forward because of age, what have you, then he goes finds a job somewhere else. He's no longer needed as the tiebreaker for, you know, for a case or what have you. So the point is that I believe, see, this was 4 minutes easily. I believe that if we made the court representative, we get away from the activism coming out of the progressive education system, and we actually start respecting the laws of the union and these boundaries and barriers to ensure that the federal government just doesn't do-si-do, you know, into the states and do whatever they want from the bench, because that has been a problem since 1800 with Marbury v. Madison. In other words, here's Marshall talking and, you know, with his chest all puffed up that they're beyond this, but he was guilty himself of being the first biased judge in pushing an agenda in aggrandizing the court. And he maintained this, he actually created the precipice, or I should say the principle, that a person, a federal employer, a federal public servant, has a property right to their job. That's where that came from, was Marbury v. Madison. So the concept of republicanism has been completely lost in the court. And once we get the federal government into compliance, this is one of the things we need to put on the table to actually re-examine the Supreme Court to reel them in. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.